The attack was a blur. The Hashashin swooped toward him like a bird of prey. Langdon, his concentration having been masterfully diverted, tried to counter, but the pipe felt like a tree trunk in his hands. His parry was too slow. The Hashashin dodged. As Langdon tried to retract the bar, the Hashashin's hands shot out and grabbed it. The man's grip was strong, his injured arm seeming no longer to affect him. Violently, the two men struggled. Langdon felt the bar ripped away, and a searing pain shot through his palm. An instant later, Langdon was staring into the splintered point of the weapon. The hunter had become the hunted. Langdon felt like he'd been hit by a cyclone. The Hashashin circled, smiling now, backing Langdon against the wall.
"What is your American adagio?" he chided. "Something about curiosity and the cat?"
Langdon could barely focus. He cursed his carelessness as the Hashashin moved in. Nothing was making sense. A sixth Illuminati brand? In frustration, he blurted, "I've never read anything about a sixth Illuminati brand."
"I think you probably have,"
the killer chuckled as he herded Langdon around the oval wall. Langdon was lost. He most certainly had not. There were five Illuminati brands. He backed up, searching the room for any weapon at all.
"A perfect union of the ancient elements," the Hashashin said. "The final brand is the most brilliant of all. I'm afraid you will never see it, though."
Langdon sensed he would not be seeing much of anything in a moment. He kept backing up, searching the room for an option.
"And you've seen this final brand?" Langdon demanded, trying to buy time.
"Someday perhaps they will honor me, as I prove myself."
He jabbed at Langdon, as if enjoying a game. Langdon slid backward again. He had the feeling the Hashashin was directing him around the wall towards some unseen destination.
"Where?"
Langdon couldn't afford to look behind him.
"The brand," he demanded. "Where is it?"
"Not here. Janus is apparently the only one who holds it."
"Janus?"
Langdon didn't recognize the name.
"The Illuminati leader. He is arriving shortly."
"The Illuminati leader is coming here?"
"To perform the final branding."
Langdon shot a frightened glance to Vittoria. She looked strangely calm, her eyes closed to the world around her, her lungs pulling slowly, deeply. Was she the final victim? Was he?
"Such conceit," the Hashashin sneered, watching Langdon's eyes. "The two of you are nothing. You will die, of course, that is for certain. But the final victim of whom I speak is a truly dangerous enemy."
Langdon tried to make sense of the Hashashin's words. A dangerous enemy? The top cardinals were all dead. The Pope was dead. The Illuminati had wiped them all out. Langdon found the answer in the vacuum of the Hashashin's eyes. The Camerlengo. Camerlengo Ventresca was the one man who had been a beacon of hope for the world through this entire tribulation. The Camerlengo had done more to condemn the Illuminati tonight than decades of conspiracy theorists. Apparently he would pay the price. He was the Illuminati's final target.
"You'll never get to him," Langdon challenged.
"Not I,"
the Hashashin replied, forcing Langdon farther back around the wall.
"That honor is reserved for Janus himself."
"The Illuminati leader himself intends to brand the Camerlengo?"
"Power has its privileges."
"But no one could possibly get into Vatican City right now."
The Hashashin looked smug.
"Not unless he had an appointment."
Langdon was confused. The only person expected at the Vatican right now was the person the press was calling the 11th-hour Samaritan. The person Rocher said had information that could save... Langdon stopped short.
"Good God!"
The Hashashin smirked, clearly enjoying Langdon's sickening cognition.
"I too wondered how Janus would gain entrance. Then in the van I heard the radio. A report about an 11th-hour Samaritan."
He smiled.
"The Vatican will welcome Janus with open arms."
Langdon almost stumbled backward. Janus is the Samaritan. It was an unthinkable deception. The Illuminati leader would get a royal escort directly to the Camerlengo's chambers. But how did Janus fool Roche? Or was Roche somehow involved?
Langdon felt a chill. Ever since he had almost suffocated in the secret archives, Langdon had not entirely trusted Roche.
The Hashashin jabbed suddenly, nicking Langdon in the side. Langdon jumped back, his temper flaring. "Janus will never get out alive!"
The Hashashin shrugged. "Some causes are worth dying for."
Langdon sensed the killer was serious. Janus coming to Vatican City on a suicide mission? A question of honor? For an instant, Langdon's mind took in the entire terrifying cycle. The Illuminati plot had come full circle. The priest whom the Illuminati had inadvertently brought to power by killing the Pope had emerged as a worthy adversary. In a final act of defiance, the Illuminati leader would destroy him.
Suddenly, Langdon felt the wall behind him disappear. There was a rush of cool air, and he staggered backward into the night. The balcony. He now realized what the Hashashin had in mind.
Langdon immediately sensed the precipice behind him, a 100-foot drop to the courtyard below. He had seen it on his way, and the Hashashin wasted no time. With a violent surge, he lunged. The spear sliced toward Langdon's midsection. Langdon skidded back, and the point came up short, catching only his shirt. Again the point came at him. Langdon slid farther back, feeling the banister right behind him. Certain the next jab would kill him, Langdon attempted the absurd. Spinning to one side, he reached out and grabbed the shaft, sending a jolt of pain through his palm. Langdon held on. The Hashashin seemed unfazed. They strained for a moment against one another, face to face, the Hashashin's breath fetid in Langdon's nostrils. The bar began to slip. The Hashashin was too strong. In a final act of desperation, Langdon stretched out his leg, dangerously off balance, as he tried to ram his foot down on the Hashashin's injured toe. But the man was a professional and adjusted to protect his weakness. Langdon had just played his final card, and he knew he had lost the hand. The Hashashin's arms exploded upward, driving Langdon back against the railing. Langdon sensed nothing but empty space behind him as the railing hit just beneath his buttocks. The Hashashin held the bar crosswise and drove it into Langdon's chest. Langdon's back arched over the chasm.
"Masalama," the Hashashin sneered. "Goodbye."
With a merciless glare, the Hashashin gave a final shove. Langdon's center of gravity shifted, and his feet swung up off the floor. With only one hope of survival, Langdon grabbed onto the railing as he went over. His left hand slipped, but his right hand held on. He ended up hanging upside down by his legs and one hand, straining to hold on. Looming over him, the Hashashin raised the bar overhead, preparing to bring it crashing down. As the bar began to accelerate, Langdon saw a vision. Perhaps it was the imminence of death, or simply blind fear, but in that moment he sensed a sudden aura surrounding the Hashashin. A glowing effulgence seemed to swell out of nothing behind him, like an incoming fireball. Halfway through his swing, the Hashashin dropped the bar and screamed in agony. The iron bar clattered past Langdon out into the night. The Hashashin spun away from him, and Langdon saw a blistering torch burn on the killer's back. Langdon pulled himself up to see Vittoria, eyes flaring, now facing the Hashashin. Vittoria waved a torch in front of her, the vengeance in her face resplendent in the flames. How she had escaped, Langdon did not know or care. He began scrambling back up over the banister. The battle would be short. The Hashashin was a deadly match. Screaming with rage, the killer lunged for her. She tried to dodge, but the man was on her, holding the torch and about to wrestle it away. Langdon didn't wait. Leaping off the banister, Langdon jabbed his clenched fist into the blistered burn on the Hashashin's back. The scream seemed to echo all the way to the Vatican.
The Hashashin froze a moment, his back arched in anguish. He let go of the torch, and Vittoria thrust it hard into his face. There was a hiss of flesh as his left eye sizzled. He screamed again, raising his hands to his face. "Eye for an eye!" Vittoria hissed. This time she swung the torch like a bat, and when it connected, the Hashashin stumbled back against the railing. Langdon and Vittoria went for him at the same instant, both heaving and pushing. The Hashashin's body sailed backward over the banister into the night. There was no scream. The only sound was the crack of his spine as he landed spread-eagle on a pile of cannonballs far below. Langdon turned and stared at Vittoria in bewilderment. Slackened ropes hung off her midsection and shoulders. Her eyes blazed like an inferno. Houdini knew yoga. Chapter 109. Meanwhile, in St. Peter's Square, the wall of Swiss guards yelled orders and fanned outward, trying to push the crowds back to a safer distance. It was no use. The crowd was too dense and seemed far more interested in the Vatican's impending doom than in their own safety. The towering media screens in the square were now transmitting a live countdown of the antimatter canister, a direct feed from the Swiss guard security monitor, compliments of the Camerlingo. Unfortunately, the image of the canister counting down was doing nothing to repel the crowds. The people in the square apparently looked at the tiny droplet of liquid suspended in the canister and decided it was not as menacing as they had thought. They could also see the countdown clock now, a little under 45 minutes until detonation. Plenty of time to stay and watch. Nonetheless, the Swiss guards unanimously agreed that the Camerlengo's bold decision to address the world with the truth and then provide the media with actual visuals of Illuminati treachery had been a savvy maneuver. The Illuminati had no doubt expected the Vatican to be their usual reticent selves in the face of adversity. Not tonight. Camerlengo Carlo Ventresca had proven himself a commanding foe. Inside the Sistine Chapel, Cardinal Mortati was getting restless. It was past 11:15. Many of the cardinals were continuing to pray, but others had clustered around the exit, clearly unsettled by the hour. Some of the cardinals began pounding on the door with their fists. Outside the door, Lieutenant Chartrand heard the pounding and didn't know what to do. He checked his watch. It was time. Captain Rocher had given strict orders that the cardinals were not to be let out until he gave the word. The pounding on the door became more intense, and Chartrand felt uneasy. He wondered if the captain had simply forgotten. The captain had been acting very erratic since his mysterious phone call. Chartrand pulled out his walkie-talkie. "Captain, Chartrand here. It's past time. Should I open the Sistine?" "That door stays shut. I believe I already gave you that order." "Yes, sir. I just..." "Our guest is arriving shortly. Take a few men upstairs and guard the door of the Pope's office. The Camerlengo is not to go anywhere."
"I'm sorry, sir?"
"What is it that you don't understand, Lieutenant?"
"Nothing, sir. I'm on my way."
Upstairs, in the office of the Pope, the Camerlengo stared in quiet meditation at the fire.
"Give me strength, God. Bring us a miracle."
He poked at the coals, wondering if he would survive the night. Chapter 110. 11:23 p.m. Vittoria stood trembling on the balcony of Castel Sant'Angelo, staring out across Rome, her eyes moist with tears. She wanted badly to embrace Robert Langdon, but she couldn't. Her body felt anesthetized, readjusting, taking stock. The man who had killed her father lay far below, dead, and she had almost been a victim as well. When Langdon's hand touched her shoulder, the infusion of warmth seemed to magically shatter the ice. Her body shuddered back to life, the fog lifted, and she turned. Robert looked like hell, wet and matted. He had obviously been through purgatory to come rescue her.
"Thank you," she whispered.
Langdon gave an exhausted smile and reminded her that it was she who deserved thanks. Her ability to practically dislocate her shoulders had just saved them both. Vittoria wiped her eyes. She could have stood there forever with him, but the reprieve was short-lived.
"We need to get out of here," Langdon said.
Vittoria's mind was elsewhere. She was staring out toward the Vatican. The world's smallest country looked unsettlingly close, glowing white under a barrage of media lights. To her shock, much of St. Peter's Square was still packed with people. The Swiss Guard had apparently been able to clear only about 150 feet back, the area directly in front of the basilica, less than one-third of the square. The shell of congestion encompassing the square was compacted now, those at the safer distances pressing for a closer look, trapping the others inside.
"They're too close," Vittoria thought. "Much too close."
"I'm going back in," Langdon said flatly. Vittoria turned, incredulous.
"Into the Vatican?"
Langdon told her about the Samaritan and how it was a ploy. The Illuminati leader, a man named Janus, was actually coming himself to brand the Camerlengo, a final Illuminati act of domination.
"Nobody in Vatican City knows," Langdon said. "I have no way to contact them, and this guy is arriving any minute. I have to warn the guards before they let him in."
"But you'll never get through the crowd." Langdon's voice was confident.
"There's a way. Trust me."
Vittoria sensed once again that the historian knew something she didn't.
"I'm coming."
"No, why risk both?"
"I have to find a way to get those people out of there. They're in incredible danger."
Just then, the balcony they were standing on began to shake. A deafening rumble shook the whole castle. Then a white light from the direction of St. Peter's blinded them. Vittoria had only one thought. Oh, my God, the antimatter annihilated early. But instead of an explosion, a huge cheer went up from the crowd. Vittoria squinted into the light. It was a barrage of media lights from the square, now trained, it seemed, on them. Everyone was turned their way, hollering and pointing. The rumble grew louder. The air in the square seemed suddenly joyous. Langdon looked baffled.
What the devil?
The sky overhead roared. Emerging from behind the tower, without warning, came the papal helicopter. It thundered 50 feet above them, on a beeline for Vatican City. As it passed overhead, radiant in the media lights, the castle trembled. The lights followed the helicopter as it passed by, and Langdon and Vittoria were suddenly again in the dark. Vittoria had the uneasy feeling they were too late, as they watched the mammoth machine slow to a stop over St. Peter's Square. Kicking up a cloud of dust, the chopper dropped onto the open portion of the square between the crowd and the basilica, touching down at the bottom of the basilica's staircase.
"Talk about an entrance," Vittoria said.
Against the white marble, she could see a tiny speck of a person emerge from the Vatican and move toward the chopper. She would never have recognized the figure, except for the bright red beret on his head.
"Red carpet greeting. That's Roche."
Langdon pounded his fist on the banister.
"Somebody's got to warn them."
He turned to go. Vittoria caught his arm.
"Wait!"
She had just seen something else. Something her eyes refused to believe. Fingers trembling, she pointed toward the chopper. Even from this distance, there was no mistaking. Descending the gangplank was another figure. A figure who moved so uniquely that it could only be one man. Although the figure was seated, he accelerated across the open square with effortless control and startling speed. A king on an electric throne. It was Maximilian Kohler. Chapter 111. Kohler was sickened by the opulence of the hallway of the Belvedere. The gold leaf in the ceiling alone probably could have funded a year's worth of cancer research. Roche led Kohler up a handicapped ramp on a circuitous route to the Apostolic Palace.
"No elevator?"
Kohler demanded. No power. Roche motioned to the candles burning around them in the darkened building. Part of our search tactic.
Tactics which no doubt failed.
Roche nodded. Kohler broke into another coughing fit and knew it might be one of his last. It was not an entirely unwelcome thought. When they reached the top floor and started down the hallway toward the Pope's office, four Swiss guards ran toward them, looking troubled.
Captain, what are you doing up here? I thought this man had information that...
He will only speak to the Camerlengo.
The guards recoiled, looking suspicious.
Tell the Camerlengo, Roche said forcefully, that the director of CERN, Maximilian Kohler, is here to see him. Immediately.
Yes, sir.
One of the guards ran off in the direction of the Camerlengo's office. The others stood their ground. They studied Roche, looking uneasy.
Just one moment, Captain. We will announce your guest.
Kohler, however, didn't stop. He turned sharply and maneuvered his chair around the sentinels. The guards spun and broke into a jog beside him.
Fermati, sir, stop!
Kohler felt repugnance for them. Not even the most elite security forces in the world was immune to the pity everyone felt for cripples. Had Kohler been a healthy man, the guards would have tackled him.
Cripples are powerless, Kohler thought. Or so the world believes.
Kohler knew he had very little time to accomplish what he had come for. He also knew he might die here tonight. He was surprised how little he cared. Death was a price he was ready to pay. He had endured too much in his life to have his work destroyed by someone like Camerlengo Ventresca.
Signore!
The guards shouted, running ahead and forming a line across the hallway.
You must stop!
One of them pulled a sidearm and aimed it at Kohler. Kohler stopped. Roche stepped in, looking contrite.
Mr. Kohler, please, it will only be a moment. No one enters the office of the Pope unannounced.
Kohler could see in Roche's eyes that he had no choice but to wait.
Fine, Kohler thought. We wait.
The guards, cruelly it seemed, had stopped Kohler next to a full-length gilded mirror. The sight of his own twisted form repulsed Kohler. The ancient rage brimmed yet again to the surface. It empowered him. He was among the enemy now. These were the people who had robbed him of his dignity. These were the people. Because of them he had never felt the touch of a woman, had never stood tall to accept an award.
What truth do these people possess? What proof, damn it? A book of ancient fables, promises of miracles to come. Science creates miracles every day.
Kohler stared a moment into his own stony eyes.
Tonight I may die at the hands of religion, he thought, but it will not be the first time.
For a moment he was 11 years old again, lying in his bed in his parents' Frankfurt mansion. The sheets beneath him were Europe's finest linen, but they were soaked with sweat. Young Max felt like he was on fire, the pain racking his body unimaginable. Kneeling beside his bed, where they had been for 2 days, were his mother and father. They were praying. In the shadows stood three of Frankfurt's best doctors.
"I urge you to reconsider," one of the doctors said. "Look at the boy. His fever is increasing. He is in terrible pain and danger."
But Max knew his mother's reply even before she said it.
"Gott wird ihn beschützen."
Yes, Max thought, God will protect me.
The conviction in his mother's voice gave him strength.
God will protect me.
An hour later, Max felt like his whole body was being crushed beneath a car. He could not even breathe to cry.
Your son is in great suffering, another doctor said. Let me at least ease his pain. I have in my bag a simple injection of
Ruabita.
Max's father silenced the doctor without ever opening his eyes. He simply went on praying.
"Father, please!" Max wanted to scream. "Let them stop the pain!"
But his words were lost in a spasm of coughing. An hour later, the pain had worsened.
"Your son could become paralyzed," one of the doctors scolded. "Or even die. We have medicines that will help."
Frau and Herr Kohler would not allow it. They did not believe in medicine. Who were they to interfere with God's master plan? They prayed harder. After all, God had blessed them with this boy. Why would God take the child away? His mother whispered to Max to be strong. She explained that God was testing him, like the Bible story of Abraham, a test of his faith. Max tried to have faith, but the pain was excruciating. "I cannot watch this," one of the doctors finally said, running from the room. By dawn, Max was barely conscious. Every muscle in his body spasmed in agony. "Where is Jesus?" he wondered. "Doesn't he love me?" Max felt the life slipping from his body. His mother had fallen asleep at the bedside, her hands still clasped over him. Max's father stood across the room at the window, staring out at the dawn. He seemed to be in a trance. Max could hear the low mumble of his ceaseless prayers for mercy. It was then that Max sensed the figure hovering over him. An angel? Max could barely see. His eyes were swollen shut. The figure whispered in his ear, but it was not the voice of an angel. Max recognized it as one of the doctors, the one who had sat in the corner for 2 days, never leaving, begging Max's parents to let him administer some new drug from England. "I will never forgive myself," the doctor whispered, "if I do not do this." Then the doctor gently took Max's frail arm. "I wish I had done it sooner." Max felt a tiny prick in his arm, barely discernible through the pain. Then the doctor quietly packed his things. Before he left, he put a hand on Max's forehead. "This will save your life. I have great faith in the power of medicine." Within minutes, Max felt as if some sort of magic spirit were flowing through his veins. The warmth spread through his body, numbing his pain. Finally, for the first time in days, Max slept. When the fever broke, his mother and father proclaimed a miracle of God. But when it became evident that their son was crippled, they became despondent. They wheeled their son into the church and begged the priest for counseling. "It was only by the grace of God," the priest told them, "that this boy survived." Max listened, saying nothing. "But our son cannot walk," Frau Kohler was weeping. The priest nodded sadly. "Yes, it seems God has punished him for not having enough faith." "Mr. Kohler," it was the Swiss guard who had run ahead, "the Camerlingo says he will grant you audience." Kohler grunted, accelerating again down the hall. "He is surprised by your visit," the guard said. "I'm sure," Kohler rolled on. "I would like to see him alone." "Impossible," the guard said. "No one..." "Lieutenant," Roche barked, "the meeting will be as Mr. Kohler wishes." The guard stared in obvious disbelief. Outside the door to the Pope's office, Roche allowed his guards to take standard precautions before letting Kohler in. Their handheld metal detector was rendered worthless by the myriad of electronic devices on Kohler's wheelchair. The guards frisked him, but were obviously too ashamed of his disability to do it properly. They never found the revolver affixed beneath his chair, nor did they relieve him of the other object, the one that Kohler knew would bring unforgettable closure to this evening's chain of events. When Kohler entered the Pope's office, Camerlengo Ventresca was alone, kneeling in prayer beside a dying fire. He did not open his eyes. "Mr. Kohler," the Camerlengo said, "have you come to make me a martyr?" Chapter 112. All the while, the narrow tunnel called Il Passetto stretched out before Langdon and Vittoria as they dashed toward Vatican City. The torch in Langdon's hand threw only enough light to see a few yards ahead. The walls were close on either side, and the ceiling low. The air smelled dank. Langdon raced on into the darkness with Vittoria close at his heels. The tunnel inclined steeply as it left the Castel Sant'Angelo, proceeding upward into the underside of a stone bastion that looked like a Roman aqueduct. There the tunnel leveled out and began its secret course toward Vatican City. As Langdon ran, his thoughts turned over and over in a kaleidoscope of confounding images. Kohler, Janus, the Hashashin, Rocher, a sixth brand.
"I'm sure you've heard about the sixth brand," the killer had said, "the most brilliant of all."
Langdon was quite certain he had not. Even in conspiracy theory lore, Langdon could think of no references to any sixth brand, real or imagined. There were rumors of gold bullion and a flawless Illuminati diamond, but never any mention of a sixth brand.
"Kohler can't be Janus," Vittoria declared as they ran down the interior of the dike. "It's impossible."
Impossible was one word Langdon had stopped using tonight.
"I don't know," Langdon yelled as they ran. "Kohler has a serious grudge, and he also has some serious influence.
This crisis has made CERN look like monsters. Max would never do anything to damage CERN's reputation."
On one count, Langdon knew CERN had taken a public beating tonight, all because of the Illuminati's insistence on making this a public spectacle. And yet he wondered how much CERN had really been damaged. Criticism from the Church was nothing new for CERN. In fact, the more Langdon thought about it, the more he wondered if this crisis might actually benefit CERN. If publicity were the game, then antimatter was the jackpot winner tonight. The entire planet was talking about it.
"You know what the promoter P.T. Barnum said?" Langdon called over his shoulder. "I don't care what you say about me, just spell my name right. I bet people are already secretly lining up to license antimatter technology. And after they see its true power at midnight tonight..."
"Illogical," Vittoria said. "Publicizing scientific breakthroughs is not about showing destructive power. This is terrible for antimatter. Trust me."
Langdon's torch was fading now.
"Then maybe it's all much simpler than that. Maybe Kohler gambled that the Vatican would keep the antimatter a secret, refusing to empower the Illuminati by confirming the weapon's existence. Kohler expected the Vatican to be their usual tight-lipped selves about the threat, but the Camerlengo changed the rules."
Vittoria was silent as they dashed down the tunnel. Suddenly the scenario was making more sense to Langdon.
"Yes! Kohler never counted on the Camerlengo's reaction. The Camerlengo broke the Vatican tradition of secrecy and went public about the crisis. He was dead honest. He put the antimatter on TV, for God's sake. It was a brilliant response, and Kohler never expected it. And the irony of the whole thing is that the Illuminati attack backfired. It inadvertently produced a new church leader in the Camerlengo. And now Kohler is coming to kill him."
"Max is a bastard," Vittoria declared. "But he's not a murderer. And he would never have been involved in my father's assassination."
In Langdon's mind, it was Kohler's voice that answered.
"Leonardo was considered dangerous by many purists at CERN. Fusing science and God is the ultimate scientific blasphemy."
"Maybe Kohler found out about the antimatter project weeks ago and didn't like the religious implications."
"So he killed my father over it? Ridiculous. Besides, Max Kohler would never have known the project existed."
"While you were gone, maybe your father broke down and consulted Kohler, asking for guidance. You yourself said your father was concerned about the moral implications of creating such a deadly substance."
"Asking for moral guidance from Maximilian Kohler?" Vittoria snorted. "I don't think so."
The tunnel banked slightly westward. The faster they ran, the dimmer Langdon's torch became. He began to fear what the place would look like if the light went out. Black.
"Besides," Vittoria argued, "why would Kohler have bothered to call you in this morning and ask for your help if he is behind the whole thing?"
Langdon had already considered it.
"By calling me, Kohler covered his bases. He made sure no one would accuse him of non-action in the face of crisis. He probably never expected us to get this far."
The thought of being used by Kohler incensed Langdon. Langdon's involvement had given the Illuminati a level of credibility. His credentials and publications had been quoted all night by the media. And as ridiculous as it was, the presence of a Harvard professor in Vatican City had somehow raised the whole emergency beyond the scope of paranoid delusion and convinced skeptics around the world that the Illuminati Brotherhood was not only a historical fact, but a force to be reckoned with. "That BBC reporter," Langdon said, "thinks CERN is the new Illuminati lair."
"What?"
Vittoria stumbled behind him. She pulled herself up and ran on.
"He said that?"
"On air. He likened CERN to the Masonic Lodges, an innocent organization unknowingly harboring the Illuminati Brotherhood within."
"My God, this is going to destroy CERN."
Langdon wasn't so sure. Either way, the theory suddenly seemed less far-fetched. CERN was the ultimate scientific haven. It was home to scientists from over a dozen countries. They seemed to have endless private funding. And Maximilian Kohler was their director.
Kohler is Janus.
"If Kohler's not involved," Langdon challenged, "then what is he doing here?"
"Probably trying to stop this madness. Show support. Maybe he really is acting as the Samaritan. He could have found out who knew about the antimatter project and has come to share information."
"The killer said he was coming to brand the Camerlengo."
"Listen to yourself. It would be a suicide mission. Max would never get out alive."
Langdon considered it. Maybe that was the point. The outline of a steel gate loomed ahead, blocking their progress down the tunnel. Langdon's heart almost stopped. When they approached, however, they found the ancient lock hanging open. The gate swung freely. Langdon breathed a sigh of relief, realizing, as he had suspected, that the ancient tunnel was in use. Recently. As in today. He now had little doubt that the four terrified cardinals had been secreted through here earlier. They ran on. Langdon could now hear the sounds of chaos to his left. It was St. Peter's Square. They were getting close. They hit another gate, this one heavier. It, too, was unlocked. The sound of St. Peter's Square faded behind them now, and Langdon sensed they had passed through the outer wall of Vatican City. He wondered where inside the Vatican this ancient passage would conclude. In the gardens? In the basilica? In the papal residence? Then, without warning, the tunnel ended. The cumbrous door blocking their way was a thick wall of riveted iron. Even by the last flickers of his torch, Langdon could see that the portal was perfectly smooth. No handles, no knobs, no keyholes, no hinges, no entry. He felt a surge of panic. In architect speak, this rare kind of door was called a senza chiave, a one-way portal, used for security and only operable from one side, the other side. Langdon's hope dimmed to black, along with the torch in his hand. He looked at his watch. Mickey glowed. 11:29 p.m. With a scream of frustration, Langdon swung the torch and started pounding on the door. Chapter 113. Something was wrong. Lieutenant Chartrand stood outside the Pope's office and sensed, in the uneasy stance of the soldier standing with him, that they shared the same anxiety. The private meeting they were shielding, Rocher had said, could save the Vatican from destruction. So Chartrand wondered why his protective instincts were tingling, and why was Rocher acting so strangely. Something definitely was awry. Captain Rocher stood to Chartrand's right, staring dead ahead, his sharp gaze uncharacteristically distant. Chartrand barely recognized the captain. Rocher had not been himself in the last hour. His decisions made no sense. "Someone should be present inside this meeting," Chartrand thought. He had heard Maximilian Kohler bolt the door after he entered. Why had Rocher permitted this? But there was so much more bothering Chartrand. The cardinals. The cardinals were still locked in the Sistine Chapel. This was absolute insanity. The Camerlengo had wanted them evacuated 15 minutes ago. Rocher had overruled the decision and not informed the Camerlengo. Chartrand had expressed concern, and Rocher had almost taken off his head. Chain of command was never questioned in the Swiss Guard, and Rocher was now top dog. Half an hour, Rocher thought, discreetly checking his Swiss chronometer in the dim light of the candelabra lighting the hall.
Please, hurry.
Chartrand wished he could hear what was happening on the other side of the doors. Still, he knew there was no one he would rather have handling this crisis than the Camerlengo. The man had been tested beyond reason tonight, and he had not flinched. He had confronted the problem head-on, truthful, candid, shining like an example to all. Chartrand felt proud right now to be a Catholic. The Illuminati had made a mistake when they challenged Camerlengo Ventresca. At that moment, however, Chartrand's thoughts were jolted by an unexpected sound. A banging. It was coming from down the hall. The pounding was distant and muffled, but incessant. Rocher looked up. The captain turned to Chartrand and motioned down the hall. Chartrand understood. He turned on his flashlight and took off to investigate. The banging was more desperate now. Chartrand ran 30 yards down the corridor to an intersection. The noise seemed to be coming from around the corner, beyond the Sala Clementina. Chartrand felt perplexed. There was only one room back there, the Pope's private library. His Holiness's private library had been locked since the Pope's death. Nobody could possibly be in there. Chartrand hurried down the second corridor, turned another corner, and rushed to the library door. The wooden portico was diminutive, but it stood in the dark like a doer's sentinel. The banging was coming from somewhere inside. Chartrand hesitated. He had never been inside the private library. Few had. No one was allowed in without an escort by the Pope himself. Tentatively, Chartrand reached for the doorknob and turned. As he had imagined, the door was locked. He put his ear to the door. The banging was louder. Then he heard something else. Voices. Someone calling out. He couldn't make out the words, but he could hear the panic in their shouts. Was someone trapped in the library? Had the Swiss Guard not properly evacuated the building? Chartrand hesitated, wondering if he should go back and consult Rocher. The hell with that. Chartrand had been trained to make decisions, and he would make one now. He pulled out his sidearm and fired a single shot into the door latch. The wood exploded, and the door swung open. Beyond the threshold, Chartrand saw nothing but blackness. He shone his flashlight. The room was rectangular, oriental carpets, high oak shelves packed with books, a stitched leather couch, and a marble fireplace. Chartrand had heard stories of this place, 3,000 ancient volumes side by side with hundreds of current magazines and periodicals, anything His Holiness requested. The coffee table was covered with journals of science and politics. The banging was clearer now. Chartrand shone his light across the room toward the sound. On the far wall, beyond the sitting area, was a huge door made of iron. It looked impenetrable as a vault. It had 4 mammoth locks. The tiny etched letters dead center of the door took Chartrand's breath away. Il Passetto. Chartrand stared. The Pope's secret escape route. Chartrand had certainly heard of Il Passetto, and he had even heard rumors that it had once had an entrance here in the library. But the tunnel hadn't been used in ages. Who could be banging on the other side? Chartrand took his flashlight and rapped on the door. There was a muffled exultation from the other side. The banging stopped, and the voices yelled louder. Chartrand could barely make out their words through the barricade. Kohler! Lie! Camerlengo! Who is that? Chartrand yelled. Langdon! Vittoria Vi... Chartrand understood enough to be confused. I thought you were dead. The door! The voices yelled. Open! Chartrand looked at the iron barrier and knew he would need dynamite to get through there. Impossible! He yelled. Too thick! Meeting! Stop! Erlengo! Danger! Despite his training on the hazards of panic, Chartrand felt a sudden rush of fear at the last few words. Had he understood correctly? Heart pounding, he turned to run back to the office. As he turned, though, he stalled. His gaze had fallen to something on the door, something more shocking even than the message coming from beyond it. Emerging from the keyholes of each of the door's massive locks were keys. Chartrand stared. The keys were here. He blinked in disbelief. The keys to this door were supposed to be in a vault someplace. This passage was never used, not for centuries. Chartrand dropped his flashlight on the floor. He grabbed the first key and turned. The mechanism was rusted and stiff, but it still worked. Someone had opened it recently. Chartrand worked the next lock, and the next. When the last bolt slid aside, Chartrand pulled. The slab of iron creaked open. He grabbed his light and shone it into the passage. Robert Langdon and Vittoria Vetra looked like apparitions as they staggered into the library. Both were ragged and tired, but they were very much alive.
"What is this?" Chartrand demanded. "What's going on? Where did you come from?"
"Where's Max Kohler?"
Langdon demanded. Chartrand pointed.
"In a private meeting with the camera—"
Langdon and Vittoria pushed past him and ran down the darkened hallway. Chartrand turned, instinctively raising his gun at their backs. He quickly lowered it and ran after them. Rocher apparently heard them coming, because as they arrived outside the Pope's office, Rocher had spread his legs in a protective stance and was leveling his gun at them.
"Halt!"
"The Camerlengo is in danger,"
Langdon yelled, raising his arms in surrender as he slid to a stop.
"Open the door! Max Kohler is going to kill the Camerlengo."
Rocher looked angry.
"Open the door," Vittoria said. "Hurry!"
But it was too late. From inside the Pope's office came a blood-curdling scream. It was the Camerlengo. Chapter 114. The confrontation lasted only seconds. Camerlengo Ventresca was still screaming when Chartrand stepped past Rocher and blew open the door of the Pope's office. The guards dashed in. Langdon and Vittoria ran in behind them. The scene before them was staggering. The chamber was lit only by candlelight and a dying fire. Kohler was near the fireplace, standing awkwardly in front of his wheelchair. He brandished a pistol, aimed at the Camerlengo, who lay on the floor at his feet, writhing in agony. The Camerlengo's cassock was torn open, and his bare chest was seared black. Langdon couldn't make out the symbol from across the room, but a large square brand lay on the floor near Kohler. The metal still glowed red. Two of the Swiss guards acted without hesitation. They opened fire. The bullet smashed into Kohler's chest, driving him backward. Kohler collapsed onto his wheelchair, his chest gurgling blood. His gun went skittering across the floor. Langdon stood stunned in the doorway. Vittoria seemed paralyzed.
"Max!"
she whispered. The Camerlengo, still twisting on the floor, rolled toward Rocher, and with the trance-like terror of the early witch hunts, pointed his index finger at Rocher and yelled a single word,
"Illuminatus!"
"You bastard!" Rocher said, running at him. "You sanctimonious bast—"
This time it was Chartrand who reacted on instinct, putting three bullets in Rocher's back. The captain fell face first on the tile floor and slid lifeless through his own blood. Chartrand and the guards dashed immediately to the Camerlengo, who lay clutching himself, convulsing in pain. Both guards let out exclamations of horror when they saw the symbol seared on the Camerlengo's chest. The second guard saw the brand upside down and immediately staggered backward with fear in his eyes. Chartrand, looking equally overwhelmed by the symbol, pulled the Camerlengo's torn cassock up over the burn, shielding it from view. Langdon felt delirious as he moved across the room. Through a mist of insanity and violence, he tried to make sense of what he was seeing. A crippled scientist, in a final act of symbolic dominance, had flown into Vatican City and branded the church's highest officials.
"Some things are worth dying for," the Hashashin had said.
Langdon wondered how a handicapped man could possibly have overpowered the Camerlengo. Then again, Kohler had a gun.
It doesn't matter how he did it. Kohler accomplished his mission.
Langdon moved toward the gruesome scene. The Camerlengo was being attended, and Langdon felt himself drawn toward the smoking brand on the floor near Kohler's wheelchair.
The sixth brand?
The closer Langdon got, the more confused he became. The brand seemed to be a perfect square, quite large, and had obviously come from the sacred center compartment of the chest in the Illuminati lair. A sixth and final brand, the Hashashin had said, the most brilliant of all. Langdon knelt beside Kohler and reached for the object. The metal still radiated heat. Grasping the wooden handle, Langdon picked it up. He wasn't sure what he expected to see, but it most certainly was not this. Langdon stared a long, confused moment. Nothing was making sense. Why had the guards cried out in horror when they saw this? It was a square of meaningless squiggles. The most brilliant of all? It was symmetrical, Langdon could tell as he rotated it in his hand, but it was gibberish. When he felt a hand on his shoulder, Langdon looked up, expecting Vittoria. The hand, however, was covered with blood. It belonged to Maximilian Kohler, who was reaching out from his wheelchair. Langdon dropped the brand and staggered to his feet. Kohler's still alive. Slumped in his wheelchair, the dying director was still breathing, albeit barely, sucking in sputtering gasps. Kohler's eyes met Langdon's, and it was the same stony gaze that had greeted Langdon at CERN earlier that day. The eyes looked even harder in death, the loathing and enmity rising to the surface. The scientist's body quivered, and Langdon sensed he was trying to move. Everyone else in the room was focused on the Camerlengo, and Langdon wanted to call out, but he couldn't react. He was transfixed by the intensity radiating from Kohler in these final seconds of his life. The director, with tremulous effort, lifted his arm and pulled a small device off the arm of his wheelchair. It was the size of a matchbox. He held it out, quivering. For an instant, Langdon feared Kohler had a weapon, but it was something else.
"Give."
Kohler's final words were a gurgling whisper.
Give this to the media.
Kohler collapsed motionless, and the device fell in his lap. Shocked, Langdon stared at the device. It was electronic. The words Sony RUVI were printed across the front. Langdon recognized it as one of those new, ultra-miniature, palm-held camcorders. The balls on this guy, he thought. Kohler had apparently recorded some sort of final suicide message he wanted the media to broadcast. No doubt some sermon about the importance of science and the evils of religion. Langdon decided he had done enough for this man's cause tonight. Before Chartrand saw Kohler's camcorder, Langdon slipped it into his deepest jacket pocket. Kohler's final message can rot in hell. It was the voice of the Camerlengo that broke the silence. He was trying to sit up.
"The cardinals," he gasped to Chartrand. "Still in the Sistine Chapel," Chartrand exclaimed. "Captain Rocher ordered..."
"Evacuate. Now. Everyone."
Chartrand sent one of the other guards running off to let the cardinals out. The Camerlengo grimaced in pain.
"Helicopter! Out front! Get me to a hospital!"
Chapter 115 In St. Peter's Square, the Swiss guard pilot sat in the cockpit of the parked Vatican helicopter and rubbed his temples. The chaos in the square around him was so loud that it drowned out the sound of his idling rotors. This was no solemn candlelight vigil. He was amazed a riot hadn't broken out yet. With less than 25 minutes left until midnight, the people were still packed together, some praying, some weeping for the church, others screaming obscenities and proclaiming that this was what the church deserved. Still others chanting apocalyptic Bible verses. The pilot's head pounded as the media lights glinted off his windshield. He squinted out at the clamorous masses. Banners waved over the crowd. Antimatter is the Antichrist. Scientist equals Satanist. Where is your God now? The pilot groaned, his headache worsening. He half considered grabbing the windshield's vinyl covering and putting it up so he wouldn't have to watch. But he knew he would be airborne in a matter of minutes. Lieutenant Chartrand had just radioed the terrible news. The Camerlengo had been attacked by Maximilian Kohler and seriously injured. Chartrand, the American, and the woman were carrying the Camerlengo out now so he could be evacuated to a hospital. The pilot felt personally responsible for the attack. He reprimanded himself for not acting on his gut. Earlier, when he had picked up Kohler at the airport, he had sensed something in the scientist's dead eyes. He couldn't place it, but he didn't like it. Not that it mattered. Roche was running the show, and Roche insisted this was the guy. Roche had apparently been wrong. A new clamor arose from the crowd, and the pilot looked over to see a line of cardinals processing solemnly out of the Vatican onto St. Peter's Square. The cardinals' relief to be leaving Ground Zero seemed to be quickly overcome by looks of bewilderment at the spectacle now going on outside the church. The crowd noise intensified yet again. The pilot's head pounded. He needed an aspirin, maybe three. He didn't like to fly on medication, but a few aspirin would certainly be less debilitating than this raging headache. He reached for the first aid kit, kept with assorted maps and manuals and a cargo box bolted between the two front seats. When he tried to open the box, though, he found it locked. He looked around for the key and then finally gave up. Tonight was clearly not his lucky night. He went back to massaging his temples. Inside the darkened basilica, Langdon, Vittoria, and the two guards strained breathlessly toward the main exit. Unable to find anything more suitable, the four of them were transporting the wounded Camerlengo on a narrow table, balancing the inert body between them as though on a stretcher. Outside the doors, the faint roar of human chaos was now audible. The Camerlengo teetered on the brink of unconsciousness. Time was running out. Chapter 116 It was 11:39 p.m. when Langdon stepped with the others from St. Peter's Basilica. The glare that hit his eyes was searing. The media lights shone off the white marble like sunlight off a snowy tundra. Langdon squinted, trying to find refuge behind the facade's enormous columns, but the light came from all directions. In front of him, a collage of massive video screens rose above the crowd. Standing there atop the magnificent stairs that spilled down to the piazza below, Langdon felt like a reluctant player on the world's biggest stage. Somewhere beyond the glaring lights, Langdon heard an idling helicopter and the roar of 100,000 voices. To their left, a procession of cardinals was now evacuating onto the square. They all stopped in apparent distress to see the scene now unfolding on the staircase. "Careful now," Chartrand urged, sounding focused as the group began descending the stairs toward the helicopter. Langdon felt like they were moving underwater. His arms ached from the weight of the Camerlengo and the table. He wondered how the moment could get much less dignified. Then he saw the answer. The two BBC reporters had apparently been crossing the open square on their way back to the press area. But now, with the roar of the crowd, they had turned. Glick and Macri were now running back toward them. Macri's camera was raised and rolling. "Here come the vultures," Langdon thought. "Alt!" Chartrand yelled. "Get back!" But the reporters kept coming. Langdon guessed the other networks would take about 6 seconds to pick up this live BBC feed again. He was wrong. They took two. As if connected by some sort of universal consciousness, every last media screen in the piazza cut away from their countdown clocks and their Vatican experts and began transmitting the same picture, a jiggling action footage swooping up the Vatican stairs. Now, everywhere Langdon looked, he saw the Camerlengo's limp body in a technicolor close-up. "This is wrong," Langdon thought.
He wanted to run down the stairs and interfere, but he couldn't. It wouldn't have helped anyway. Whether it was the roar of the crowd or the cool night air that caused it, Langdon would never know. But at that moment, the inconceivable occurred. Like a man awakening from a nightmare, the Camerlengo's eyes shot open and he sat bolt upright. Taken entirely by surprise, Langdon and the others fumbled with the shifting weight. The front of the table dipped. The Camerlengo began to slide. They tried to recover by setting the table down, but it was too late. The Camerlengo slid off the front. Incredibly, he didn't fall. His feet hit the marble, and he swayed upright. He stood a moment looking disoriented, and then, before anyone could stop him, he lurched forward, staggering down the stairs toward Macri. "No!" Langdon screamed. Chartrand rushed forward, trying to rein in the Camerlengo, but the Camerlengo turned on him, wild-eyed, crazed. "Leave me!" Chartrand jumped back. The scene went from bad to worse. The Camerlengo's torn cassock, having been only laid over his chest by Chartrand, began to slip lower. For a moment Langdon thought the garment might hold, but that moment passed. The cassock let go, sliding off his shoulders down around his waist. The gasp that went up from the crowd seemed to travel around the globe and back in an instant. Cameras rolled, flash bulbs exploded. On media screens everywhere, the image of the Camerlengo's branded chest was projected, towering and in grisly detail. Some screens were even freezing the image and rotating it 180 degrees. The ultimate Illuminati victory. Langdon stared at the brand on the screens. Although it was the imprint of the square brand he had held earlier, the symbol now made sense. Perfect sense. The marking's awesome power hit Langdon like a train. Orientation. Langdon had forgotten the first rule of symbology. When is a square not a square? He had also forgotten that iron brands, just like rubber stamps, never looked like their imprints. They were in reverse. Langdon had been looking at the brand's negative. As the chaos grew, an old Illuminati quote echoed with new meaning. A flawless diamond, born of the ancient elements, with such perfection that all those who saw it could only stare in wonder. Langdon knew now the myth was true. Earth, air, fire, water. The Illuminati diamond. Chapter 117 Robert Langdon had little doubt that the chaos and hysteria coursing through St. Peter's Square at this very instant exceeded anything Vatican Hill had ever witnessed. No battle, no crucifixion, no pilgrimage, no mystical vision, nothing in the shrine's 2,000-year history could possibly match the scope and drama of this very moment. As the tragedy unfolded, Langdon felt oddly separate, as if hovering there beside Vittoria at the top of the stairs. The action seemed to distend, as if in a time warp, all the insanity slowing to a crawl. The branded Camerlengo, raving for the world to see. The Illuminati diamond, unveiled in its diabolical genius. The countdown clock registering the final 20 minutes of Vatican history. The drama, however, had only just begun. The Camerlengo, as if in some sort of post-traumatic trance, seemed suddenly puissant, possessed by demons. He began babbling, whispering to unseen spirits, looking up at the sky and raising his arms to God. "Speak!" the Camerlengo yelled to the heavens. "Yes, I hear you!" In that moment Langdon understood. His heart dropped like a rock. Vittoria apparently understood, too. She went white. "He's in shock," she said. "He's hallucinating. He thinks he's talking to God." "Somebody's got to stop this," Langdon thought. It was a wretched and embarrassing end. Get this man to a hospital. Below them on the stairs, Chinita Macri was poised and filming, apparently having located her ideal vantage point. The images she filmed appeared instantly across the square behind her on media screens, like endless drive-in movies, all playing the same grisly tragedy. The whole scene felt epic. The Camerlengo, in his torn cassock, with a scorched brand on his chest, looked like some sort of battered champion who had overcome the rings of hell for this one moment of revelation. He bellowed to the heavens, "Ti sento Dio!" "I hear you, God!" Chartrand backed off, a look of awe on his face. The hush that fell across the crowd was instant and absolute. For a moment, it was as if the silence had fallen across the entire planet. Everyone in front of their TVs rigid, a communal holding of breath. The Camerlengo stood on the stairs before the world and held out his arms. He looked almost Christ-like, bare and wounded before the world. He raised his arms to the heavens and, looking up, exclaimed, "Grazie! Grazie Dio!" The silence of the masses never broke. "Grazie Dio!" the Camerlengo cried out again. Like the sun breaking through a stormy sky, a look of joy spread across his face. "Grazie Dio!" "Thank you, God?" Langdon stared in wonder. The Camerlengo was radiant now, his eerie transformation complete. He looked up at the sky, still nodding furiously. He shouted to the heavens, "Upon this rock I will build my church." Langdon knew the words, but he had no idea why the Camerlengo could possibly be shouting them. The Camerlengo turned back to the crowd and bellowed again into the night, "Upon this rock I will build my church." Then he raised his hands to the sky and laughed out loud. "Grazie Dio, grazie." The man had clearly gone mad. The world watched, spellbound. The culmination, however, was something no one expected. With a final joyous exultation, the Camerlengo turned and dashed back into St. Peter's Basilica. Chapter 118. 11:42 p.m. The frenzied convoy that plunged back into the basilica to retrieve the Camerlengo was not one Langdon had ever imagined he would be part of, much less leading. But he had been closest to the door and had acted on instinct. "He'll die in here," Langdon thought, sprinting over the threshold into the darkened void. "Camerlengo, stop!" The wall of blackness that hit Langdon was absolute. His pupils were contracted from the glare outside, and his field of vision now extended no farther than a few feet before his face. He skidded to a stop. Somewhere in the blackness ahead, he heard the Camerlengo's cassock rustle as the priest ran blindly into the abyss. Vittoria and the guards arrived immediately. Flashlights came on, but the lights were almost dead now, and didn't even begin to probe the depths of the basilica before them. The beams swept back and forth, revealing only columns and bare floor. The Camerlengo was nowhere to be seen.
"Camerlengo!" Chartrand yelled, fear in his voice. "Wait, signore!"
A commotion in the doorway behind them caused everyone to turn. Chinita Macri's large frame lurched through the entry. Her camera was shouldered, and the glowing red light on top revealed that it was still transmitting. Glick was running behind her, microphone in hand, yelling for her to slow down. Langdon could not believe these two. This is not the time.
"Out!" Chartrand snapped. "This is not for your eyes."
But Macri and Glick kept coming.
"Chinita!" Glick sounded fearful now. "This is suicide. I'm not coming."
Macri ignored him. She threw a switch on her camera. The spotlight on top glared to life, blinding everyone. Langdon shielded his face and turned away in pain.
"Damn it!"
When he looked up, though, the church around them was illuminated for 30 yards. At that moment, the Camerlengo's voice echoed somewhere in the distance.
"Upon this rock I will build my church."
Macri wheeled her camera toward the sound. Far off, in the grayness at the end of the spotlight's reach, black fabric billowed, revealing a familiar form running down the main aisle of the basilica. There was a fleeting instant of hesitation as everyone's eyes took in the bizarre image. Then the dam broke.
Chartrand pushed past Langdon and sprinted after the Camerlingo. Langdon took off next, then the guards and Vittoria. Macri brought up the rear, lighting everyone's way and transmitting the sepulchral chase to the world. An unwilling Glick cursed aloud as he tagged along, fumbling through a terrified blow-by-blow commentary. The main aisle of St. Peter's Basilica, Lieutenant Chartrand had once figured out, was longer than an Olympic soccer field. Tonight, however, it felt like twice that. As the guards sprinted after the Camerlingo, he wondered where the man was headed. The Camerlingo was clearly in shock, delirious, no doubt, from his physical trauma and bearing witness to the horrific massacre in the Pope's office. Somewhere up ahead, beyond the reach of the BBC spotlight, the Camerlingo's voice rang out joyously. "Upon this rock I will build my church." Chartrand knew the man was shouting scripture. Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, if Chartrand recalled correctly. "Upon this rock I will build my church." It was an almost cruelly inapt inspiration. The church was about to be destroyed. Surely the Camerlingo had gone mad. Or had he? For a fleeting instant, Chartrand's soul fluttered. Holy visions and divine messages had always seemed like wishful delusions to him, the product of overzealous minds hearing what they wanted to hear. God did not interact directly. A moment later, though, as if the Holy Spirit himself had descended to persuade Chartrand of his power, Chartrand had a vision. 50 yards ahead, in the center of the church, a ghost appeared, a diaphanous, glowing outline. The pale shape was that of the half-naked Camerlingo. The specter seemed transparent, radiating light. Chartrand staggered to a stop, feeling a knot tighten in his chest. "The Camerlingo is glowing!" The body seemed to shine brighter now. Then it began to sink, deeper and deeper, until it disappeared, as if by magic, into the blackness of the floor. Langdon had seen the phantom also. For a moment he, too, thought he had witnessed a magical vision. But as he passed the stunned Chartrand and ran toward the spot where the Camerlingo had disappeared, he realized what had just happened. The Camerlingo had arrived at the niche of the palliums, the sunken chamber lit by 99 oil lamps. The lamps on the niche shone up from beneath, illuminating him like a ghost. Then, as the Camerlingo descended the stairs into the light, he had seemed to disappear beneath the floor. Langdon arrived breathless at the rim overlooking the sunken room. He peered down the stairs. At the bottom, lit by the golden glow of oil lamps, the Camerlingo dashed across the marble chamber toward the set of glass doors that led to the room holding the famous golden box. "What is he doing?" Langdon wondered. "Certainly he can't think the golden box." The Camerlingo yanked open the doors and ran inside. Oddly, though, he totally ignored the golden box, rushing right past it. 5 feet beyond the box, he dropped to his knees and began struggling to lift an iron grate embedded in the floor. Langdon watched in horror, now realizing where the Camerlingo was headed. Good God, no! He dashed down the stairs after him. "Father, don't!" As Langdon opened the glass doors and ran toward the Camerlingo, he saw the Camerlingo heave on the grate. The hinged iron bulkhead fell open with a deafening crash, revealing a narrow shaft and a steep stairway that dropped into nothingness. As the Camerlingo moved toward the hole, Langdon grabbed his bare shoulders and pulled him back. The man's skin was slippery with sweat, but Langdon held on. The Camerlingo wheeled, obviously startled. "What are you doing?" Langdon was surprised when their eyes met. The Camerlingo no longer had the glazed look of a man in a trance. His eyes were keen, glistening with a lucid determination. The brand on his chest looked excruciating. "Father," Langdon urged as calmly as possible, "you can't go down there. We need to evacuate." "My son," the Camerlingo said, his voice eerily sane, "I have just had a message. I know."
"Camerlingo!"
It was Chartrand and the others. They came dashing down the stairs into the room, lit by Macri's camera. When Chartrand saw the open grate in the floor, his eyes filled with dread. He crossed himself and shot Langdon a thankful look for having stopped the Camerlengo. Langdon understood, had read enough about Vatican architecture to know what lay beneath that grate. It was the most sacred place in all of Christendom. Terra Santa, holy ground. Some called it the necropolis, some called it the catacombs. According to accounts from the select few clergy who had descended over the years, the necropolis was a dark maze of subterranean crypts that could swallow a visitor whole if he lost his way. It was not the kind of place through which they wanted to be chasing the Camerlengo.
"Signore," Chartrand pleaded, "you're in shock. We need to leave this place. You cannot go down there. It's suicide."
The Camerlengo seemed suddenly stoic. He reached out and put a quiet hand on Chartrand's shoulder.
"Thank you for your concern and service. I cannot tell you how. I cannot tell you I understand. But I have had a revelation. I know where the antimatter is."
Everyone stared. The Camerlengo turned to the group.
"Upon this rock I will build my church. That was the message. The meaning is clear."
Langdon was still unable to comprehend the Camerlengo's conviction that he had spoken to God, much less that he had deciphered the message. "Upon this rock I will build my church?" They were the words spoken by Jesus when he chose Peter as his first apostle. What did they have to do with anything? Macri moved in for a closer shot. Glick was mute, as if shell-shocked. The Camerlengo spoke quickly now.
"The Illuminati have placed their tool of destruction on the very cornerstone of this church, at the foundation."
He motioned down the stairs.
"On the very rock upon which this church was built. And I know where that rock is."
Langdon was certain the time had come to overpower the Camerlengo and carry him off. As lucid as he seemed, the priest was talking nonsense. "A rock? The cornerstone and the foundation?" The stairway before them didn't lead to the foundation. It led to the necropolis.
"The quote is a metaphor, Father. There is no actual rock."
The Camerlengo looked strangely sad.
"There is a rock, my son."
He pointed into the hole.
"Pietro e la pietra."
Langdon froze. In an instant it all came clear. The austere simplicity of it gave him chills. As Langdon stood there with the others, staring down the long staircase, he realized that there was indeed a rock buried in the darkness beneath this church.
"Pietro e la pietra."
Peter is the rock. Peter's faith in God was so steadfast that Jesus called Peter the rock, the unwavering disciple on whose shoulders Jesus would build his church. On this very location, Langdon realized, Vatican Hill, Peter had been crucified and buried. The early Christians built a small shrine over his tomb. As Christianity spread, the shrine got bigger, layer upon layer, culminating in this colossal basilica. The entire Catholic faith had been built, quite literally, upon St. Peter, the rock.
"The antimatter is on St. Peter's tomb," the Camerlengo said, his voice crystalline.
Despite the seemingly supernatural origin of the information, Langdon sensed a stark logic in it. Placing the antimatter on St. Peter's tomb seemed painfully obvious now. The Illuminati, in an act of symbolic defiance, had located the antimatter at the core of Christendom, both literally and figuratively, the ultimate infiltration.
"And if you all need worldly proof," the Camerlengo said, sounding impatient now, "I just found that grate unlocked."
He pointed to the open bulkhead on the floor.
"It is never unlocked. Someone has been down there. Recently."
Everyone stared into the hole. An instant later, with deceptive agility, the Camerlengo spun, grabbed an oil lamp, and headed for the opening.
Chapter 119. The stone steps declined steeply into the earth.
I'm going to die down here, Victoria thought, gripping the heavy rope banister as she bounded down the cramped passageway behind the others. Although Langdon had made a move to stop the Camerlengo from entering the shaft, Chartrand had intervened, grabbing Langdon and holding on. Apparently the young guard was now convinced the Camerlengo knew what he was doing. After a brief scuffle, Langdon had freed himself and pursued the Camerlengo, with Chartrand close on his heels. Instinctively, Victoria had dashed after them. Now she was racing headlong down a precipitous grade where any misplaced step could mean a deadly fall. Far below, she could see the golden glow of the Camerlengo's oil lamp. Behind her, Victoria could hear the BBC reporters hurrying to keep up. The camera's spotlight threw gnarled shadows beyond her down the shaft, illuminating Chartrand and Langdon. Victoria could scarcely believe the world was bearing witness to this insanity. Turn off the damn camera! Then again, she knew the light was the only reason any of them could see where they were going. As the bizarre chase continued, Victoria's thoughts whipped like a tempest. What could the Camerlengo possibly do down here? Even if he found the antimatter, there was no time. Victoria was surprised to find her intuition now telling her the Camerlengo was probably right. Placing the antimatter 3 stories beneath the earth seemed an almost noble and merciful choice. Deep underground, much as in Z-Lab, an antimatter annihilation would be partially contained. There would be no heat blast, no flying shrapnel to injure onlookers, just a biblical opening of the earth and a towering basilica crumbling into a crater. Was this Kohler's one act of decency, sparing lives? Victoria still couldn't fathom the director's involvement. She could accept his hatred of religion, but this awesome conspiracy seemed beyond him. Was Kohler's loathing really this profound? Destruction of the Vatican? Hiring an assassin? The murders of her father, the Pope, and 4 cardinals? It seemed unthinkable. And how had Kohler managed all this treachery within the Vatican walls? Rocher was Kohler's inside man, Victoria told herself. Rocher was an Illuminatus. No doubt Captain Rocher had keys to everything. The Pope's chambers, Il Pazzetto, the necropolis, St. Peter's tomb, all of it. He could have placed the antimatter on St. Peter's tomb, a highly restricted locale, and then commanded his guards not to waste time searching the Vatican's restricted areas. Rocher knew nobody would ever find the canister. But Rocher never counted on the Camerlengo's message from above. The message. This was the leap of faith Victoria was still struggling to accept. Had God actually communicated with the Camerlengo? Victoria's gut said no, and yet hers was the science of entanglement physics, the study of interconnectedness. She witnessed miraculous communications every day. Twin sea turtle eggs separated and placed in labs thousands of miles apart, hatching at the same instant. Acres of jellyfish pulsating in perfect rhythm, as if of a single mind. There are invisible lines of communication everywhere, she thought. But between God and man? Victoria wished her father were there to give her faith. He had once explained divine communication to her in scientific terms, and he had made her believe. She still remembered the day she had seen him praying and asked him, "Father, why do you bother to pray? God cannot answer you." Leonardo Vetra had looked up from his meditations with a paternal smile. "My daughter the skeptic, so you don't believe God speaks to man? Let me put it in your language." He took a model of the human brain down from a shelf and set it in front of her. "As you probably know, Victoria, human beings normally use a very small percentage of their brain power. However, if you put them in emotionally charged situations, like physical trauma, extreme joy or fear, deep meditation, all of a sudden their neurons start firing like crazy, resulting in massively enhanced mental clarity." "So what?" Victoria said. "Just because you think clearly doesn't mean you talk to God." "Aha!" Victoria exclaimed. "And yet remarkable solutions to seemingly impossible problems often occur in these moments of clarity. It's what gurus call higher consciousness. Biologists call it altered states. Psychologists call it supersentience.
he paused. "And Christians call it answered prayer." Smiling broadly, he added, "Sometimes divine revelation simply means adjusting your brain to hear what your heart already knows." Now, as she dashed down headlong into the dark, Vittoria sensed perhaps her father was right. Was it so hard to believe that the Camerlengo's trauma had put his mind in a state where he had simply realized the antimatter's location? "Each of us is a god," Buddha had said. "Each of us knows all. We need only open our minds to hear our own wisdom." It was in that moment of clarity, as Vittoria plunged deeper into the earth, that she felt her own mind open, her own wisdom surface. She sensed now, without a doubt, what the Camerlengo's intentions were. Her awareness brought with it a fear like nothing she had ever known. "Camerlengo, no!" she shouted down the passage. "You don't understand!" Vittoria pictured the multitudes of people surrounding Vatican City, and her blood ran cold. "If you bring the antimatter up, everyone will die!" Langdon was leaping three steps at a time now, gaining ground. The passage was cramped, but he felt no claustrophobia. His once debilitating fear was overshadowed by a far deeper dread. "Camerlengo!" Langdon felt himself closing the gap on the lantern's glow. "You must leave the antimatter where it is. There's no other choice." Even as Langdon spoke the words, he could not believe them. Not only had he accepted the Camerlengo's divine revelation of the antimatter's location, but he was lobbying for the destruction of St. Peter's Basilica, one of the greatest architectural feats on earth, as well as of all the art inside. "But the people outside, it's the only way." It seemed a cruel irony that the only way to save the people now was to destroy the church. Langdon figured the Illuminati were amused by the symbolism. The air coming up from the bottom of the tunnel was cool and dank. Somewhere down here was the sacred necropolis, burial place of St. Peter and countless other early Christians. Langdon felt a chill, hoping this was not a suicide mission. Suddenly, the Camerlengo's lantern seemed to halt. Langdon closed on him fast. The end of the stairs loomed abruptly from out of the shadows. A wrought iron gate with three embossed skulls blocked the bottom of the stairs. The Camerlengo was there, pulling the gate open. Langdon leapt, pushing the gate shut, blocking the Camerlengo's way. The others came thundering down the stairs, everyone ghostly white in the BBC spotlight, especially Glick, who was looking more pasty with every step. Chartrand grabbed Langdon. "Let the Camerlengo pass." "No," Vittoria said from above, breathless. "We must evacuate right now. You cannot take the antimatter out of here. If you bring it up, everyone outside will die." The Camerlengo's voice was remarkably calm. "All of you, we must trust. We have little time." "You don't understand," Vittoria said. "An explosion at ground level will be much worse than one down here." The Camerlengo looked at her, his green eyes resplendently sane. "Who said anything about an explosion at ground level?" Vittoria stared. "You're leaving it down here?" The Camerlengo's certitude was hypnotic. "There will be no more death tonight." "Father, but please, some faith." The Camerlengo's voice plunged to a compelling hush. "I am not asking anyone to join me. You are all free to go. All I am asking is that you not interfere with his bidding. Let me do what I have been called to do." The Camerlengo's stare intensified. "I am to save this church, and I can. I swear on my life." The silence that followed might as well have been thunder.